So welcome back, officially. We had started Yehoshua last year in a different venue, but nonetheless, same series. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, we worked our way through essentially the first two-thirds of chapter 5. Does that sound right?
You think you got to 5?
I know he got to 5. Okay. I can tell you how I know he got to 5.
Tell us.
Because that's where my notes go up to. But the last thing we did, if I'm not mistaken, was the relationship between Korban Pesach and Brit Milah. Does that sound familiar at all?
Yes, I was
yes.
There.
Okay. Yeah, it does sound right. So chapter 5 begins with those two events, the Korban Pesach, the Brit Milah of all of Israel, and the Korban Pesach, which they bring for the first time in Gilgal. I'm going to move this map over to here, since we're all sitting around here. Right, remember that as they come into Israel, they're all encamped. I'll give you a copy of this map next week, but they're all encamped in the main camp, which is in Gilgal. Right, they enter into the land of Israel from this direction, and the Machaneh, the entire, essentially the camp of Israel, is sitting here in this region, Gilgal, and just north of Gilgal. That Gilgal on the map is just north of the city of Yericho. There in Gilgal, after they crossed the Yarden, we had a whole discussion about crossing the Jordan and what it meant and how they did it and the parallel to the splitting of the sea. Well, I'm not going to review all of the course from last year, but nonetheless, the first major event that happens when they come into the land of Israel is a national circumcision of all the males, Brit Milah, followed by the first Korban Pesach in 39 years. Remember that discussion that they hadn't brought the Korban Pesach through all the years they were in the desert after the sin of the spies. This was the first Korban Pesach that they brought in 39 years. And the relationship between Brit Milah and Korban Pesach was essentially where I think we had ended our discussion last year. Which brings us to Perek He, Pasuk Yud Gimel, chapter 5, verse 13. Does anybody not have a Tanakh? Because we have some extras here. One of the advantages is. Okay. That's a good question. Perek Hei Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayihi biyot Yehoshua biyericho. Yehoshua is in Yericho. Why is Yehoshua in Yericho? We haven't touched Yericho yet. We haven't gotten to Yericho. How is Yehoshua in Yericho? Who mentioned Yericho? How did we get to Yericho? Vayihi biyot Yehoshua biyericho. How did we get to Yericho? We walked into Yericho? What are we talking about? So that's why I wanted you to see the map. Gilgal is here. Yericho is here. In other words, Gilgal, there isn't a city called Gilgal. They go and they camp in this area, and after the Brit Milah, they name the place Gilgal because of the Gal, if you remember the heap. So they named the place Gilgal. The camp of Israel is sitting on the outskirts of Yericho. So it says it came to pass while Yehoshua was in Yericho means at this point the focus is going to shift to the conquest of Yericho. The next chapter is the battle of Yericho. So they're setting the stage. Now Yehoshua, after Brit Milah, after Korban Pesach, Yeshua is in Gilgal, on the outskirts of Yericho, ready to enter Yericho. The next little episode is going to take place, and then beginning of Perek Vav, we are ready to go into Yericho, and the battle plan for Yericho is going to be it's just north of Yericho. The camp of Israel is sitting just north of Yericho. That's not an accident. The first major Canaanite city that we are going to take is Yericho. Yericho, the Gemara calls Yericho the Aklida de Eretz Yisrael, the key to Eretz Yisrael. Aklida de Eretz Canaan. Take Yericho and you have opened the key, you've opened the door to the land of Canaan. Why? Strategically. Right, why? Well, first of all, it's a walled city. The walled cities are always an issue. And second of all, look where it's located. It's the center of the land of Israel. I'm going to digress for a moment, but I think it's important. The rest of our study of Yehoshua this year is going to be focused primarily on the strategic battle plan for the conquest of Canaan. And it's important to note from the outset there that they're essentially Yehoshua, as he's sitting here in the security and safety of his camp of Israel and looking out at the land of Israel, or the land of Canaan, and exploring the question of how to conquer the territory. He is faced with primarily two strategic challenges. And the majority of the story of Yehoshua's conquest is an address to how to deal with these two issues in one way or another. What are those two issues? What challenges him essentially in the conquest of Canaan? Issue number one are the walled cities. Remember that Yeshua's army is an army of foot soldiers. The strategic advantage in a walled city always goes to those who are inside the wall, because the wall protects them. Right? You're on top, you're in the ramparts, you can throw down, you can, right? You have to breach the wall or conquer the wall to get to the to people inside. And that's, I don't need to disclose major plot spoiler here. We know that the conquest of Yericho takes place because they're able to take out the wall. That's not going to happen every city in Israel. They're not going to take the wall out in every city that they address. So one of the major challenges Yehoshua is going to face is how to deal with the walled cities, how to deal with the army protected within the wall. There are essentially three ways. Yericho style, you take out the wall. Or what are the other two options? The obvious one is you breach the wall, which is the harder one. And the third option, which is the easier one, is somehow either get in, but that's less likely because they're in the wall to protect themselves. But what is possible is draw them out. Correct. And we will see that as Yehoshua goes through the land of Israel, how many times he's able to get the army that's within the walls and draw them outside of the walls. That's part of them. So that's a strategic move. Only way to address the issue of a walled city is either to take out the wall, breach the wall, or take the army out from within its protection. The second strategic issue that Yehoshua faces is you're an army, you're sitting here, here's the land of Israel before you. Not in modern terms, but in ancient terms. What's the second major strategic challenge that Yehoshua faces? Excuse me?
Provision
of what?
Provisions
meaning food and
yeah.
Yes and no, that's not necessarily a strategic challenge. There's certainly produce in the fields, there's produce in the land. We said in this parak that ate of the produce of the land. The man stops, but there's other sources of provisions. So from a strategic point of view, if we're looking at the battle plan, Yeshua faces a different issue. How large is the army of Israel? What's the size of the Israelite army? What's the size of the Israelite army?
You all know it. You all know it. This, the answer to this question, you know. You just don't know that you know. But you definitely know. The size of the Israelite army. Sure, it can be. In military terms, it's enormous. Probably the single largest fighting force in the Middle East. Give up. Okay, so let me give you a hint. How many times does the Torah... How many times in the Torah do we find a census of the numbers of Israel? At least three, correct. Three different occasions from Yitzhak Mitzrayim until the time they enter the land of Israel. Three different places that count B'nai Israel. Right? Agreed? Parshat Bamidbar, Parshat Pinchas, and there's an early one in Parshat Kitisa. What's the number? What's the general? Give me, round it off to the nearest 100,000. What's the number of the census? 600,000, give or take. In Parshat Bamidbar, it's 603,550. Parshat Bamidbar, it's something else, but it's essentially around 600,000. That's why we say that B'nai Israel were, right, the number, the size of Israel was 600,000, otherwise known in Hebrew as Shishim Ribo. It's 60 times 10,000, or 600,000. Who was counted? No. Yeah. Who is counted? Kol zachar lemishpachotam levet avotam legugulotam kol yotzei tzava biYisrael. All of the adult males above the age of 20. Why? Because only the males count and the females don't count, right? Right. Why do you count only the males above the age of 20? Because that's the army. There's no point. The census is not a general census to decide how big you are, how large you are, to be able to print the latest almanac of the size of the Jewish people. The census had a very specific purpose, namely to determine the camp of Israel. The census was a military census. And we know that primarily from Parshat Bamidbar. When they count B'nai Israel at the same time, what did they do to the camp? What do they do to the structure of the camp? When they took the census of B'nai Israel and Parshat Bamidbar, what did they do to the camp of Israel? They divided them, right? By?
Age or male female?
No. Never by male female. Right, by tribes. And then they combined tribes together into... Familiar with the census in Bamidbar? Yeah, we've talked about it. It's very important for Yeshua because it's the foundation of the whole operation of the Israelite army.
And all these other armies were less than 600,000.
Well, I'm going to talk about all the other armies in a moment.
That's kind of what you implied.
Correct. And I'm going to talk about all those other armies. 600,000 adult men above the age of 20 who served in the army. Kol Yotzei Tzava. So what's the size of the army? So what's the size of the army? If the census was 603,550, what's the size of the army? 603,550. That is the census. It's not, here's the census and that tells me how many soldiers there are. The census is the military census. It is the accounting of how many soldiers do I have. And not only does it tell me how many soldiers do I have, let's open up for a moment to Bamidbar. For a moment. Buzz is going to be. You get the buzz?
Yeah.
It's going to drive me nuts. No, it's the air conditioning. It's the air. Okay, we'll fix that problem.
What are you going to do? Call the Israeli army?
Just wait.
So
take a look. For example, let's start with Perek Aleph, just so we get an idea of who's in this census. Perek Aleph, Bamidbar Perek Aleph, Pasuk Bet. Everybody have it? Se'u et vosh kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Count the heads of all of the congregation of Israel. Lemishpachotam leveit avatam, according to families and households. B'mispar shemot kol zechar legugulatam, every male. Miben esim shana v'malo, from 20 years and up. Kol yotzei tzava Yisrael. Those who serve in the army of Israel. Simple equation. Counting has a particular purpose. Chapter 1 divides everybody by tribes and counts each tribe. But look what happens in chapter 2. Right? And every time it says, Kol Yotzei Tzava. At the expression, at the end of every paragraph, you'll see it says, from 20 and up, those who serve in the army. Ben Asim Shanav Amala, Kol Yotzei Tzava B'Yisrael. 20 is the age of conscription in the Torah. Today it's 18, but it's essentially the same. Because today it's determined by the state of Israel, not by the Torah. But the Torah had an age of conscription of 20. Chapter 2. Ish Pasuk Bet, Ish Al Diglo, Be'otot Levet Avotam Yachanu B'nei Yisrael. As they camp around the Mishkan, they would camp Ish Al Diglo, each according to their Degel. We'll talk about the word Degel in a moment. And then we define the camps. Hachonim Kedma Mizracha Degel Machane Yehuda. The east camp is the camp of Yehuda. But with Yehuda are two other tribes, namely Hachonim Alav, with Yehuda goes together Yisachar and Zvulun. Utsvao Ufkudav, his army, his size, and his officers. The total size of the army of Yisachar is 45,000. And Zvulun, Utsvao Ufkudav, his army and his officers, 75,000. Kol Hapkudim, all of those who are counted, Machane Yehuda, the total size of the camp of Yehuda, Me'at Elef Ushmanim Elef Sheshet Alafim, 186,000, etc., and change. In other words, how are we now subdivided the camp of Israel? Initially by tribes, and now by Degalim. Each Degel, there are essentially four Degalim, one for each side of the Mishkan. Each Degel comprised of three tribes, with one tribe being the primary tribe, and the other two attached to it. So I have a larger unit than just the tribe. So now I've divided the entire camp of Israel into subunits called each tribe by itself, and then larger units combining those tribes into groups, all under a degel. What's a degel? So you should know something about the word degel. The word degel in Tanakh is not a flag. It's more analogous to the word banner. Banner is different from a flag, although they're connected, they're related. But essentially, when you talk about a degel, or a degel of a machane, remember that the word machane in Tanakh does not mean day camp, summer camp. Machane means camp, but it doesn't mean summer camp. The word machane has one connotation and one connotation only, namely, it is always a military camp. You encamp the army. And that's why the process...
What's the verb to encamp?
The verb, the machnot. Machnot. Chone. Degel hachonim kedma. The encampment on the east. Right? The notion of dividing Israel into a machane is because from the time they leave Egypt, they are headed after Mamre HaSinai. Remember, this doesn't happen before Mamre HaSinai. This happens after Mamre HaSinai. There are no machanot before Mamre HaSinai. They're just a group of tribes standing together at Sinai to accept the Torah. But at that point, they're headed where? They're headed to the land of Israel. And the plan is to get to the land of Israel in how long? Remember, we're before Parashat Shlach. We're before the story of the miraculum. How long are we planning? How long is the plan? Of what is the plan as to how long it will take to go from Sinai to Eretz Yisrael?
Short.
3 days. From Sinai, they travel, they get 3 days to get to Kadesh, and there is a jumping point to the land of Israel. The original plan was to go this way. From Sinai, straight up the Negev to Kadesh, and from Kadesh into Hebron, and to conquer the land of Israel from the south. They're 3 days a week at most from the land of Israel, which means that when they leave Sinai, they have to be ready for war. And the process of counting them is not just so they can know how large they are. The process of counting them was to prepare them for battle, to divide them into platoons and brigades and groups and whatever other military units there are. Right? That was essentially the division. You had to know the size of each brigade, you had to know the size of each tribe, and you had to put officers and people in charge, and you had a tzeva, and you're ready to go. So your army is essentially 600,000 foot soldiers. What don't they have? Army of Israel, 600,000 foot soldiers. What don't they have? Well, they have commanders, they have the generals, they have nesi'im, they have leaders. What they don't have is armament. They have swords and spears. They don't have tanks. They don't have an air force.
What would they use, horses?
Right? And they don't have horses, and they don't have chariots. The biblical version of the tank is the chariot. And the Israelite army does not have chariots. And that's not an accident. The Torah actually prohibits us from acquiring chariots by virtue of the Torah's limitation on the king. Remember in Parshat Shoftim it says at some point or another you're going to appoint a king. When you appoint a king, there are three limitations on a king, on a monarch. They are, can't have too many wives, translate that into can't have too many political alliances, can't have too much gold and silver. And the third one is the most obscure. The third limitation on the king is lo yarbelo susim. He's not allowed to have too many horses. Pen yachzira ta'am mitzrayim, lest he go back to Egypt leman harbot sus, in order to acquire horses. Because the source of horses in the ancient Middle East was Egypt. So if you limit the dependence on horses, you limit the dependence on foreign power. It's essentially the ancient equivalent of the modern concept of being energy independent, so that you're not dependent upon foreign powers for your financial and military strength.
Maybe you should call our government.
Right, but that's the equation. Lo yarbelo susim. You're not allowed to have too many horses. So don't build an army based on tanks and air force planes, because that will make you dependent upon foreign power for the source of your armament. Build an army based on the resources you have, namely 600,000 foot soldiers. 600,000 soldiers is an enormous fighting force in the parameters of the ancient world. It has one Achilles heel. Actually, two. One Achilles heel is the numbers of soldiers are not a significant factor when you're fighting a walled city, because the wall gives the insiders an advantage even against the larger numbers. And the second Achilles heel is that they don't have chariots. They can't compete against a chariot-driven army. Chariot-driven army is essentially the equivalent in today's military terms of a fighting force of a foot soldiers fighting against a tank without a bazooka. Was done as they're about to leave Sinai on the way to Israel. And then they had a, as they say in Israel, kara pancha. Right? Then they had a detour. They had a problem, namely
They ran into the sin of the spies. And what the sin of the spies does is it sends them back into the desert. This is Kadesh Barnea. This is where they send the spies from. The plan was to send the spies straight up into Hebron and to conquer Israel from the south. Straight up. The best laid plans of mice and men, in this case, the mice being the Israelites, didn't work, and they were frightened, so they get turned around, go back down into the desert, and from here they head back into the wilderness for 40 years, until they come around the land of Ammon and Moab, and now have to enter into the land from the east. So the battle plan changes. The battle plan was originally to go from the south and just walk right through. The battle plan is now to come in from the center. But you're still dealing with, despite the two Achilles heel, namely the walls and the chariots, you're still dealing with an enormous fighting force. This is a fighting force, essentially, that will break up by tribes and settle the entire breadth of the country north to south, which means that it's a fighting force capable of conquering, protecting, and holding on to the entire country. It's enormous. The Egyptian army is not in the equation here. The Canaanite army is in the equation. And this brings us to our second point. There is no Canaanite army. Because Canaan was not a nation. Canaan was, besides being seven nations, right? There were seven nations. There's no such thing as nations in the ancient world, with the exception of the empires. The empires are Egypt in the south, and much later in time, we'll get to the empires of the Assyrians in the north, but for the most part, the only were Mesopotamia and Egypt. What do you have here? You have a whole bunch of cities. And in each city, there is a king. Every city in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan, has its own king.
He was referred to as king?
Absolutely. You have Melech Devir, Melech Yishalayim, and Melech. In chapter, if you take a look in Yoshua chapter 12, there's a list of all the kings that Yoshua conquers. And they're listed by cities. Chapter 12, Yoshua chapter 12. They're listed by cities. Melech Yericho, Melech Ai, Melech Yishalayim, Melech Hebron, Melech Yarmut, Melech Lachish, Melech Eglon, Melech Gezer, Melech Devir, Melech Gezer, etc. In which you have a city-state. And every city-state has its own king, its own government, its own army.
So that's why you said they're the largest.
Correct.
Each one of these.
Because you have essentially a fighting force that's united amongst all the tribes of Israel.
They fight in each city.
Right.
Which
brings me to the second strategic issue.
They fight in each city.
Correct.
That one city
they will fight in each city, one city.
Yeah.
Now, you take the army of Jericho. The army of Jericho, how many could they beat? 5,000? 10,000? How many could there be in Jericho? Against the fighting force of 600,000. What's the problem?
The walls.
The walls. So breach the wall and the city will fall. There's no challenge in Jericho once you breach the wall. Jericho is a nothing. It's a cakewalk.
But they have to figure out how to get
through. They have to get through the wall. So Yeshua faces two strategic challenges. That's how we started this discussion. Strategic challenge number one are the walls of the cities. Remember, almost every ancient city has a wall. Jericho has a wall. Hebron has a wall. Almost every city he's going to get to is a walled city, because that's how they protected themselves. There were city-states, there were individual armies. The second strategic challenge, what happens if the local cities realize that they are being walked over by a fighting force of 600,000? What do you think the king of Devir and the king of Yushalayim and the king of Lachish and the king of Yarmut are going to do when they see a fighting force of 600,000 marching their way? What would you do? Some did. Girgashi did. Alternatively, it's your country. Join together. So the king of Devir, the king of Yishalayim, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmut, and king of Lachish get together and say, hey, listen, alone we're going to do nothing. Unite together and we'll push them out. And if they do that, then they're a force to contend with. So the second strategic issue Yeshua is going to face is this battle has to take place quickly, and it has to do so in a way that prevents the local kings from uniting into an alliance against them.
His advantage militarily is in his numbers. Allow the local kings to unite, you lose that advantage. So those were his two strategic challenges. Number one, how to breach the wall, how to draw the armies out of the wall or breach the wall, either one. And number two, how to prevent the armies from uniting. To do that, what's the most logical military strategy to prevent the local nation, kings from uniting? Either surprise, or you can only surprise at the beginning. After that, you lose the surprise. Everybody knows. Once you pass Yeruch, everybody... And the truth is, there is no element of surprise. After Kriyat Yarden, remember the spies who come to Rachab in Yericho. After the splitting of the Yarden, there's no surprise left. Right? The water miles high. Everybody knows the Israeli army is sitting on their border. So the element of surprise is gone. What other military strategy could Yeshua employ to prevent the locals from uniting? Simple. Not looking for nothing too sophisticated. Very simple. You want to prevent them from uniting.
Okay, some forces that
fight them at the same time.
Divide. What's the expression? Divide and conquer. And that's precisely the strategy that Yeshua will employ. Just, we haven't even looked at the text, but look at the map. Look at the arrow. What's his battle plan?
Send them to all those places.
What's the battle plan? Jericho, and then? North and south? Or south, north, south and the north? By what part of the country? Through the center? Right through the center of the heartland. In other words, Yeshua is going to go city by city, but he's going to go through the country along two axes. Center, east-west, and then north-south, right along the middle. The goal here is divide them, prevent them from uniting. It's not significantly different from the strategy that the Arabs tried in the Six-Day War, which was to try to cut Israel, or in the 48 War, which is to try to cut Israel in half down the middle, right, to get to Tel Aviv and divide the country in half. The country's strength lies in its unity. Divide the country, you weaken the country. That was why the split of the kingdom later on in history, in the time of Solomon, the split of the kingdom north-south into Judah and Israel was so devastating to the country. Because you divide the country north and south and you weaken the country. And here, they're not even united. They're a whole bunch of separate city-states. If you allow them to unite because they have a common enemy, you weaken yourself. So Yeshua has two agendas. Number one, take out the walls. And number two, find a way to conquer quickly and divide the country into regions that will prevent the local cities from uniting together, the local armies from uniting together. Those two strategies will define the methodology of Yeshua through the entire Sefer. At least through till chapter 12, which is our primary course of study for the year. Is that clear? So when we... This was all an introduction to our opening three words in Perek Hey, Pasuk Yegimel, which was Vahi Biyot Yeshua B'Yericho. Yeshua is in Yericho. Yericho is significant. It's vitally important. Number one, it's the Chazal call it the key to the portal to Eretz Yisrael. It's the key for two reasons. Number one, it's a walled city. It's a major metropolis. It's a major cultural center of Israel. But it's also dead center, which means that you can't get into the heart of the country unless you march through Yericho. So take Yericho out and you send a tidal wave through the country, east-west, north-south. Everything revolves around that battle. It builds the momentum. From there, you march, but you can't march till you get through Yericho. Correct. Yeshua is a brilliant study in strategy. They say that David Ben-Gurion studied Sefer Yehoshua start to finish, inside, outside, upside down, and inside out, before engaging the military battles of Israel. It is a remarkable treatise on military strategy. And we'll see, part of our course of study this year is to understand what the challenges were. I entitled the course Challenges and Opportunities. What his challenges were in the conquest of Israel and how he transformed them into opportunities. What essentially is going on, both strategically, militarily, as well as spiritually in the process. But there's no question that Yehoshua is looking at this conquest from a strategic perspective. Moshe didn't have to worry about strategy. Why didn't Moshe have to worry about strategy?
He wasn't.
Well, he was to some extent. He fought two major battles. Three. He fought the Egyptian army, and he fought the Sihon army and the army of Og Melech HaBashan. Moshe essentially fought three major battles in his life. He didn't have to worry too much about strategy. Why? Simply put, why didn't he have to worry about strategy for against the Egyptians? Because the whole war was fought by God. What did Moshe do at Kriyat Yamsuf? He stood there with the staff in the air and went, okay, God. Hashem yilachem lachem atem tacharishun was the message. God will fight your battles, you will be silent. Here's the staff, open up the sea. Sea separates, Israel goes through, sea comes back, Egypt's gone. Hashem ish mechama. God is a God of war, that's a man of war. That's exactly what they said in Kriyat Yamsuf. They didn't lift a finger in Kriyat Yamsuf. Against Og and against Sihon, they had to fight. Okay, so God comes to Moshe before the battle and says, don't worry, I'll be with you. The battle's over in a day or two.
But he said the same thing to Joshua.
Oh. For reasons we have yet to determine, Yehoshua has to conquer Canaan, and he has to think through the entire military strategy from A to Z. What Moshe didn't have to think about, Yehoshua has to think about on a regular basis. Yehoshua has to lead this battle smartly, and he has to do it militarily. The answer to the question as to why will be one of our subjects of study as we go through the Sefer. That's the question we need to answer. What makes it different? Absolutely could have. That's the question of why, and that's the question we will answer over the course of this year. Not today. Not next week, not the week after, but over the course of time we will take that piece, that question, and develop it. That's really the fundamental question of the message of Sefer Yehoshua.
So you're
going to
answer it?
Yeah, absolutely. If you come back every week, you'll get an answer. All right. Let's go. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayehi. Biyot Yehoshua Biricho. It was when Yehoshua was in Yericho, and now we know why he's in Yericho. Why he's sitting outside Yericho. Vayisa Enav Vayar. And of course, he's ready for war. He's prepared his army for war. Vayisa Enav Vayar. He lifts up his eyes and he sees. Vine Ish Omed L'Negdo. And he sees a man standing there. V'charbosh lufa biyado, with his sword drawn. He's standing ready for war. It's an army. There are enemies all around. He's in enemy territory. Agreed? He's in enemy territory. And he sees an armed man standing in front of him, I presume standing too close for comfort, meaning that for some reason, unbeknownst to Yehoshua, this man with this sword drawn managed to get past all of the defenses that they must have set up around the camp of Israel. This man is sitting in the camp. If he's standing opposite Yehoshua, Yehoshua is not on the outskirts of the camp. Where is Yehoshua? He's the general. Where is Yehoshua? Vis-a-vis the camp of Israel. If this is
do this schematically, this is Yericho, and this is Machane Yisrael. Where is Yehoshua physically? I would assume he's right here, because who is the most important person in the camp? Who is the person you want to protect more than anything else? And suddenly Yehoshua lifts up his eyes and he sees standing next to him a man with a sword. Right. So how did he get through? Who is this guy? So you understand the shock. Vayelech Yehoshua Elav. Yehoshua approaches him, I assume carefully. Vayomer lo, and he says to him, Halanu ata im litzareinu. Are you for us or against us? In modern terms, we would say, it's night, it's the middle of the night, you don't know who the guy is, all you see is a man with a sword. First question you ask is, if you get to the point of asking the question, right, if you don't shoot first, right, today the orders are shoot first, but otherwise, right, what's the first question you ask? For us or against us, or in modern terms, friend or foe? Identify yourself. Password. Something. Friend or foe. Vayomer. Well, we'll see what else he could be. Vayomer. His answer. Lo. Kis ani sar tzva Hashem. Atabati. No. I am neither for you or against you. I guess that's what the lo means. I am. You misunderstand the whole context of the story. I am. Sar Tzva Hashem. Sar Tzva Hashem means the officer of the army of God, the ministering angel of the army of God. Sar Tzva Hashem. Atabati, I have come now. Vayipol Yehoshua al panav arza, Yehoshua falls on his face to the ground. Vayishtachu, when he bows down. Vayomer lo, and he says to this person who he now understands to be an angel of God. Ma adonim medaber alav do. What does my master say to his servant? Notice the change in tone. Before it was friend or foe, what's the password? Now he's falling on the face, he's prostrating himself before him, and he says, what does my master speak to his servant? Sar Tzva Hashem says to Yehoshua, Shal na'alcha me'al raglecha. Take off thy shoes from thy feet. Ki ha'makom asher ata omed alav kodeshu. Correct. It's exactly the same parallel, the same story in the burning bush, exactly the same parallel. We will compare these two in a moment. Take thy shoes off from thy feet, upon thy feet, because the land upon which you stand is holy ground. Vayas Yehoshua came, and Yehoshua does so. That's the end of Perakei. Beginning of Perak Vav, V'yiricho sogeret u'mesugeret mipnei b'nei Yisrael en yotze ve'en ba. Yiricho is closed off, sealed because of Israel. No one goes in and no one comes out. No one goes in, meaning? Right? Meaning the Israel army is sitting on the outside. They can't get in because the walls are sealed. Nobody comes out. Who is that referring to? The Canaanites, the Yerichoites. Because why can't they go out? Why can't they go out? Answer that question first. Because Israel has surrounded them. In other words, Israel is not just sitting here. I described this schematically as Yericho over here and Israel over here. That's actually not what's going on. What's going on is Yericho is over here and Israel is over here. They besieged Yericho and Yeshua is sitting there in the middle of the night. And this Sar Tzva Hashem comes to him and he says to him, take off thy shoes from upon thy feet, the land upon which you stand is holy ground.
Yeshua takes his shoes off, and that's the end of the parak. And then parak Vav begins. Yericho is enclosed and besieged. Nobody goes in, nobody goes out. Let's do a couple more psukim, pasuk bet. It's a very funny ending.
Then everything's sealed off. That's
right.
Like leaving you like
hanging. What's going on? Correct. Correct. It's very strange. And that's our first question. And I'll explain to you how, in a moment, what we're going to do with that question. But that's exactly the sense that we're left with, hanging. Pasuk Bet. Notice the paragraph break. You all have paragraph breaks in your Tanakhs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Vayomer Hashem el Yehoshua. God said to Yehoshua, "Erei netati biyadecha et Yericho et Malka, giborei hachayil. Behold, I have given into your hands Yericho and its king, mighty men of war. Don't worry about Yericho. I will hand you Yericho. V'sabotem et ha'ir kol anshei milchama, hakef et ha'ir pamachat. This is the battle plan. Surround the city, all the men of war, surround the city once. Go around the walls of the city, make a hakafa, right? Right? Do a hakafa around the city once. By the way, the root of the word hakafa is a Yiddish pronunciation of the word, but the word is hakafa, and the root of hakafa is hakef. Just said it. Hakef et ha'ir pam achat. I didn't draw that analogy by accident. That analogy is intentional. Surround the city once for 6 days. V'shivat kohanim yisu shivat shofrot hayovlim lifnei ha'aron. And seven kohanim, carrying seven shofars, will blow the shofar before the ark each day. Uvayom ha'shvi'i, on the seventh day, tasabu et ha'ir sheva pamim. You will surround the city and do seven hakafot around the city. What chag parallels that sequence? Simchas Torah has seven hakafot, but that's actually a borrowed parallel. The parallel is actually Sukkos, because Hoshanas we do once each day of Hoshanas, and then Hoshana Rabbah we do seven. Hoshana Rabbah is the seventh day of the holiday, right? V'akohanim yitku b'shofarot, and on that seventh day the kohanim will blow the shofar. V'aya b'mshoch b'keren hayovel, when you will extend the keren hayovel, the blow of the shofar, kishamachem et kol hashofar, when they will hear the sound of the shofar, yariu kol ha'am trua gdola, let the people sound a great trua, great noise, v'nafla komat ha'ir tachteha, and the walls of the city will fall beneath itself. And then, once the walls fall, then all of Israel standing surrounding the city, ish negdo, each one just goes into the city from all sides and they just pounce. At that point, there's no resistance. At that point, it's finished. That's the battle plan. The rest of it is the implementation. It makes it sound real easy, and that's true. So let's go back to the story of the malach. I want to spend the rest of today and next week's shiur on the story of this malach. This malach is really a fascinating little interlude. And the first question that we have to ask, that we asked you here before, is this story leaves you hanging. So what's going on? So there's two possible ways of understanding this story. And the first question, which is a textual one, but it's the key to the answer to this question, is to which chapter does this story belong? Where is the chapter division in this text? Where is the end of chapter 5 and the beginning of chapter 6? Look at the text. Tell me, where does the chapter transition? Is this story part of chapter 5 or the beginning of chapter 6?
I would say it's part of
6,
but it's in chapter 5.
It's in chapter 5. So from a chapter division point of view, which of course is a limited source for information because the chapter divisions are not of Jewish origin,
but they do tell me something. Right. Chapter 5 ends with the instruction to take your shoes off because you're standing on holy ground. That's the end of chapter 5. And what happened in chapter 5? What happened in chapter 5? What was the basis? What were the events of chapter 5? And chapter 5. What's the primary story of chapter 5? What we did at the end of last year? That's not the primary story of chapter 5. What's the primary story of chapter 5? Brit Milah and Korban Pesach. Brit Milah and Korban Pesach. The end of that story is this Malach comes to Yeshua and says, take your shoes off, you're standing on holy ground. And that's how the chapter ends. The reference to Yericho is the beginning of chapter 6. Yericho is twice. Verse 13 of chapter 5, it says, Vayi b'yot Yeshua b'yericho, and verse 6, and chapter 6 begins, V'yericho m'segeret m'segeret. But if I look at it from a chapter division, it could be that this whole story is really the end of the story of Brit Milah and Korban Pesach. Essentially saying to him, after you've achieved Brit Milah, after you've done the Korban Pesach, after you've done all of this preparation, spiritual preparation, you're now standing on holy ground, and therefore take your shoes off. As if you're standing in the Beit HaMikdash. In which case the story, it ends. It ends. It's the end of chapter 5.
But there was an interruption.
Where?
We're only told to take the shoes off.
That's it. You don't need more than that. But if the story is the conclusion of chapter 5, that's all I need. Because all I'm told, all essentially the story is telling me is, this has nothing to do with Yericho. This is essentially the close of the story of Brit Milah and Korban Pesach. After you've done Brit Milah, you've gone back to the status of Bnei Yisrael before Chet HaMeraglim, after you've done Korban Pesach, you've gone back to the status of Bnei Yisrael before Chet HaEgel, we've brought them back to the Mikdash, to the Shechina, to the place of the Snev, of Har Sinai, and therefore take your shoes off, and you are on Admat Kodesh. Kiss the ground, and life goes on. That's one way to read it. The problem is, as we correctly pointed out, number one, the chapter divisions are not of Jewish origin, and number two, take a look at how the paragraphs divide this. And the paragraph division is of Jewish origin. Where's the paragraph divide? Yeah. Correct. In other words, this story of the Malach, according to the paragraph, concludes with a description of the siege of Yericho. That's part of the story. The Malach comes and he says, Sartzva Hashemani, take your shoes off. Yeshua takes his shoes off. Yericho is besieged on all sides. Israel is holding Yericho siege. What's one have to do with the other? Unless the assumption is that this Malach has nothing to do with the story of Korban Pesach and Brit Milah, but is in fact the introduction to the conquest of Yericho, which would explain why it starts with the phrase Vahi b'yot Yeshua b'Yericho. The paragraph begins with the description of Yeshua in Yericho, not in Gilgal, but in Yericho. And it ends with the description of the siege of Yericho. And in the middle, I have this little episode with the Malach. So it sounds like this story is not, in fact, the conclusion of chapter 5, but in fact, rather, the introduction to chapter 6, the introduction to the story of Yericho and its conquest. Take a look. The source page that I've given you. At the first source, which is the Radak. The Radak, I think the Radak is responding essentially to this question. Where do I put the story of the angel? And where, you understand that wherever I put the story of the angel changes, dramatically changes the message of the angel.
If the message of the angel is connected somehow to the story of Korban Pesach, then the message of the angel is simply what? Gilu Ishchina, revelation of God's presence, Hai Sinai, that's it, take your shoes off, story's over. If the story of the angel is in some way connected to the Battle of Jericho, then it's an introduction, then the story is a military story. It has something to do with the conquest of Jericho, it has something to do with the siege of Jericho. Then I still have to figure out what the shoes are doing in that story. What does taking off the shoes have to do with the Battle of Jericho? But there's another issue. In the story of the Malach itself, who is speaking to Yehoshua? Who is speaking to Yehoshua directly? The conversation is between Yehoshua and the Malach, Sartzva Hashem. Correct? Vayomer Loki. I've come now. Take your shoes off. He takes his shoes off. Perek Vav Pasuk Bet begins Vayomer Hashem Elav. Or Vayomer Hashem El Yehoshua. God speaks to Yehoshua. How? Through Nevuah. Through Nevuah, right? Says the Radak. And here you see how the Radak understood this whole story. In source number one, Vayomer Hashem El Yehoshua, when the Navi says that Hashem spoke to Yehoshua, it means Al Yedei HaMalach HaNir'alo, that God spoke to him through the Malach that just appeared to him. V'hu Nikra B'Shem Hashem HaShaleach Oto, he is speaking on behalf of God who sent him, and therefore it's as if God is speaking to him. Similarly, in Gidon, later in Sefer Shoftim, it starts with the story of Gidon, who is one of the Shoftim, who meets a Malach, and he greets the Malach, and the Malach greets him, and this whole conversation, introductory conversation with the Malach, and then it says, "Vayomer Elav Hashem ki ani ayeimach." God says to him, "I will be with you." And God says to him, he's talking to a Malach. "V'mu Chazal ki shmi b'kirbo." The Malach can say God, the Malach can speak in the name of God as if this in first person. I, because the Malach represents God. Not that there's an identification of the Malach with God, but the Malach represents God. So he says, as if to say, God who sent me has said to you X, Y, and Z. But the text can describe it as Vayomer Elav Hashem. There's an identification of purpose. Every malach represents God and therefore can speak in the name of God. The most famous example of the same kind of textual play, in other words, we're dealing with a situation where the malach comes to an individual at first, introduction of communication between an individual and the malach, and suddenly in the middle of that conversation it says that God spoke to him. So was there a first level of prophecy and then a second level of prophecy? Or does it mean that God spoke through the agency of the angel? I'll give you another very famous example of this transition. Since we're talking about taking your shoes off, go back to Moshe at the burning bush. With whom did Moshe speak at the burning bush?
Who was Moshe speaking to at the burning bush?
Now, of course, you're all stunned by the question, right? Because who else could he be speaking to except to God, right? So take a look in chapter 3 of Shemot. I'll show you something that we probably miss every time we read the parsha. Moshe was functioning as the shepherd of his father-in-law's flock. He took the tzon to the end of the midbar. And he gets to this mountain called the Mountain of God, or Chorev. Vayera malach Hashem elav bilabat ish mitoch hasneh. And the malach of God appeared to him in the form of a fire from within the bush. Vayar, he saw vine hasne bo'er v'asne nenu ukal. He said the bush is burning, but it's not being consumed. And Moshe says, "Let me go and see this great sight." Pasuk Dalid. Vayar Hashem kisalu ot vayikra elav Elokim mitoch hasne. God saw that he turned, and God called out to him from within the bush. V'yomer Moshe, Moshe, v'yomer ineni, v'yomer al tikrav alom, shan alecha mi'avaglecha, ki ha'makom esher ata omed al avat matkodeshu. Don't get too close, take your shoes off, you're standing on holy ground. Anochi elokei avicha, elokei avram, etc., etc., etc. Who is he talking to? Clearly he's talking to God, right? Except that that's not what it says in Pasuk Gimel. What does it say in Pasuk Gimel? That who appeared to him? A malach Hashem. So one of two things has to happen. Either I have to say that the malach appears to him first and then disappears and God takes over, or if I parallel the story of the snare to the story here, which is a remarkable parallel because the opening statement of both is identical, take your shoes off. It's the same phraseology, take your shoes off because you're standing on holy ground. In both cases, the communication starts with the malach and then changes to the name of God, but not because God takes over, but because the malach speaks in the name of God. And it could very well be that Moshe was speaking to the malach the whole time. Much as Yeshua is speaking to this malach here. And if that's true, then what message does the malach convey to Yeshua? What's the message? What does the malach here say to Yehoshua? Specifically, chart it out. What communication does the malach here give to Yehoshua? Communication number one?
I'm Sar Tzva Hashem.
Communication number two?
I'm going to give you Richo into your hands.
The communication number three? No, actually that's number three. What's communication number two? Take your shoes off. Right? Take your shoes off. And then Vayomer Hashem El Yehoshua Ve'ena Tati Biyadecha Et Yericho Ve'et Makah. I've given Yericho and its king into your hands. Here's the battle plan for Yericho. Surround the city 7 days. Each day you surround the city once. You do one hakafa. On the seventh day you're going to do seven hakafas. Take the konim, seven konim, seven shofot, etc. The whole battle plan articulated in chapter 6 between Pasuk Bet and Pasuk Hey, that whole battle plan is essentially communicated to him by whom? Hashem? No, says the Radak.
It's communicated through Sar Tzva Hashem,
through this malach. And the story of this malach is not the adjunct, the postscript to the story of Brit Milah and Korban Pesach. The story of this malach is in fact the introduction to the battle plan for Yericho. And if that's the case, what land, what ground is holy ground to which the malach refers to when he says the land upon which you stand is holy ground? All of Israel.
That means after they captured.
I don't know what it means. All I know is he says take your shoes off right now because you're standing on holy ground. What holy ground is he standing on? He doesn't take his shoes off for the rest of the battle of Canaan, by the way. He's standing on holy ground. What holy ground is he standing on? He's nowhere near it. He's nowhere near Mount Zion. What holy ground is he standing on? No, you won't want to say it. You're just afraid to say it. You say it. Yericho. He's standing on Yericho. And the Malach says to him, you're standing on holy ground. Take your shoes off. And here's the battle of how we're going to take Yericho, and here's what we're going to do for the walls, and here's what you're going to do. You're going to surround the city for 7 days because we're standing on holy ground. What holy ground are we talking about? Yericho. Oh, so now we have our list of questions. Question number one, why do I need this malach to convey the battle plan? What's the relationship? What's his role in all of this? It's not the first. Yeshua has spoken to God many times and will continue to speak to God many times. Why do I need a Sar Tzva Hashem? What do I need this angel for? What's his role in all of this? Question number two we have not addressed at all, but how is it that Yeshua is so confused by who this malach is Remember how the story begins. He sees this man standing there with the sword drawn, and he says, I don't know who you are. Tell me, are you friend or foe? The last time we saw Malachim, I don't think we confused them for human beings. How does Yeshua get him confused? Question number two. Question number three, the parallel to the Sneh. Where's the link to, what's the link to Moshe about taking his shoes off? And question number four, which is I think the most critical question, is what's the correlation between taking your shoes off and the battle plan for Yericho? If the message is the battle plan for Yericho, so give him the battle plan for Yericho. What do I have to bother taking your shoes off? Understand the problem? That's our introduction. So our introduction to Yericho is going to revolve around these shoes. Bezvat Hashem, next week we will... There is a class next week. Yes, there is definitely a class next week. The week following, I won't be here. But next week, I will be here.